الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dr. Cullen, dear friends, it's a pleasure for me to participate this afternoon in a meeting of minds with my old friend, Professor Harvey Cox of Harvard University, whom I've met over the years on different occasions. And we really do not stand at the two opposite ends of the spectrum of religious thought by any means. There are many views that we share in common, of course, views in which we differ. In any case, during the next 20 minutes, I want to discuss with you the question of religion, modernity, and the future, what I conceive to be the situation, the major questions that arise, and what it is that we are facing. And then afterwards, when Professor Cox speaks, I shall speak to you again in response to what he says. This idea was really, I think, Dr. Cullen's, and this encounter, and in a positive sense, a dialogue at the present moment between thinkers from different religions and worldviews, I think is of the utmost importance. Rarely in human history have such discussions been as important as they are today. But we should not fool ourselves. Unfortunately, they're not as important as they should be, because despite the dialogue that goes on, the level of incomprehension, opposition, vilification of the other increases throughout the world, especially when we come to the relationship between Islam and the West and the Christianity. The situation of the opposition to Islam and what's called Islamophobia is very much on the rise in both Europe and America. It's an issue with which we have no choice as Muslims to deal. And there are many important Christian thinkers who are also concerned with this, including Professor Harvey Cox himself. Now, let's start with religion. In the 19th century, many, many European thinkers believed that the very natural process of history, which at that time they identified as progress, would end up with a demise and total, might say, marginalization of religion. Those who were openly anti-religious, like Feuerbach and Karl Marx and Auguste Comte, and others who were more or less indifferent to it, but most thinkers in the West believed that religion was on the wane. We do not have a single sociologist of the earlier 20th century, not one, who predicted that in the second half of the 20th century, religion would be on the rise again. And I believe that the current wave of aggressive and militant atheism, which has arisen in the last few years, and which has mostly to do with the English-speaking world. There are very few of those people in Italy or Germany or many other, or South America, but they're almost all from the United Kingdom and the United States. But nevertheless, this reaction is to a large extent due to the fact that the demise of religion did not take place, and that in fact religion is on the rise, and the fact that it had to rise in a world dominated by the forces of secularism, of course, that has brought often with it aggression, what's called aggressive fundamentalism, wars, and so forth and so on, of which we're all aware. But rarely do we pay attention to the deeper causes that are involved. One of the most important reasons for the rise of religion is the fall of the gods which had replaced the god of religion. Gods such as progress, such as the whole paradigm of modernism, which began to crack from the First World War on and really cracked in the middle of the 20th century. Postmodernism, which grew out of it, tried to, in a sense, dilute and arbitrate and deconstruct the very foundation of modernism, although itself belonged to that world. But anyway, the downfall of modernism, I think, is one of the most important reasons why the ground was opened up for religion to reassert itself. I remember once speaking with a very prominent American religious scholar, theologian in New York. And the question of making use of religion to solve human problems came up. And the skeptical American said, oh, don't give us that again, so-and-so. He said, why not? We've tried everything else. Everything else was tried, from socialism to intense nationalism, pure humanism, materialism, in the 19th and 20th centuries. And their failure, their incredible failure, of course, is one of the reasons, not the only reason, that has led many people worldwide back to religion. This, I think, is true in the West to a large extent, as far as Christianity is concerned, where you have two parallel events going on. Of course, Professor Harvey Cox knows much more than I do in this field, but, and we'll talk to you about it, but I, since I'm as a Muslim supposed to give a comment upon Christianity as well, what we see in the West is, on the one hand, the continuous secularization of a number of people, of certain institutions, of challenges of moral laws which had originally a Christian foundation, as we see in the so-called cultural wars in the United States, which are really religious wars about the question of abortion, the origin of life, euthanasia, all kinds of things I will not get into. And on the other hand, the revival of interest in religion, which I happen to be a graduate of Harvard University. I taught there once. Professor Harvey Cox, a professor at Harvard University. Just take the example of Harvard, which was the bastion of secularism going back to the 18th century in a certain sense, with President Pusey, when he became president of Harvard, the reassertion of interest in religion and the new status given to the Divinity School, even before Professor Cox joined the faculty. These, I think, were all signs of the return of interest in religion in a new way. And so we have the process which is now called by major sociologists of religion, including Peter Berger, famous American sociologist of religion, who had always talked about secularization and modernization, meaning secularization, the idea of the de-secularization of the world. He talks, there's a fact he came out with a book with that title. That is the very process of secularization, which meant the destruction of the sacred, that's what secularization really meant, that itself was being undone in all parts of the world, except, according to him, and of course according to myself, in Europe, in Western Europe, for reasons which I will not get into at the present moment. So I believe that as far as Christianity is concerned, you have two sort of crisscrossing movements going on. There are many Catholic families in America whose children no longer go to church or go to Mass only once in a while on Christmas Eve, and Protestants the same. At the same time, there are many people who are groping for religion, and some come back to Christianity. A lot of them so-called newborn Christians. There are these evangelical movements that are going on, which in fact are the most energetic element of Christianity today. How deep they are intellectually, how long they will last, that's the story for another day. And you have also the groping for religion outside of Christianity in the West, that includes almost all the Oriental religions like Buddhism and Hinduism, and also, of course, Islam. So let me turn to the Islamic religion. I believe that this process which I just described with you for you exists mutatis mutandis, that there's a certain amount of change because of the condition for Islam itself. First of all, Islam did not invent modernism. It was at the receiving end. Islam did not produce a whole army of atheists like Europe produced from 17th century onward, when Bale began to write in France, all the way up to Richard Rorty, who died last year. All these philosophers, atheistic philosophers, Islam did not produce that. But it was at the receiving end of the waves of modernism, one after another, and this city, in fact, was one of its main centers. Many of the modernizing forces in the rest of the Islamic world first came to Istanbul and to Turkey and all the Ottoman Empire, and spread from there to many places, including my own country, Iran, or Egypt, and other places far south and east. But the faith, the iman of the people, was not challenged in the same way as Christian faith was challenged in Europe. It did not receive as many deep wounds. But nevertheless, from the late 19th century on, gradually, even in the Islamic world, in many countries but not all, gradually Islam was marginalized as far as the public arena was concerned. Not completely, I repeat, but to some extent marginalized. And the minority that ruled over many Islamic countries, westernized, secularized minorities, in the name of a future which they identified with secularism, dominated over vast majorities of Muslims. And still talked about democracy, of course, but nevertheless, that was not what was going on. That did not affect so deeply the faith of the people. But intellectually, the intellectual classes in the Islamic world suffered in one way or another. The class of the ulama, religious scholars, became more and more separated from the newly trained classes of scholars, thinkers, who were trained in modern universities in various Islamic countries, the oldest ones being like the University of Istanbul, the University of the Punjab, Tehran University, Fuad University in Cairo, and later on the other universities that came around. And those people, most of the people who came out of these universities, they were not interested seriously in Islam as a religion. We do not see any major Islamic thinkers coming out of this process in the early days. But that began to change also, I believe, after the Second World War, with the same events and the same reasons that we see in the West, that is the weakening of modernism. It was not so difficult, I've always said jokingly to Persians, in 1938-1939, before the Second World War, for a Persian or Turkish or Arabic, the so-called intellectual, who really loved this country without doubt, to consider Western Europe to be like paradise, like the Kaaba, bowing before it in every way and every field. They seemed to be so successful. After the 20-30 Europeans killed each other in the Second World War, that was much more difficult. And as you began to see in Europe, the poetry of the greatest poets of the English language, like T.S. Eliot, writing the Four Quartets, or Ezra Pound, or so much of Italian and French poetry that came out, seeing the blight of the spiritual landscape, many, many Muslims realized that they cannot simply substitute Paris for paradise. Paris is the French pronunciation of Paris. Paris is not paradise. We have to think of something else. There has to be another model. We have to do something ourselves. And this very shaking of that model, the falling of the gods, as I called it, opened the ground for a new phase in the reassertion of Islamic thought, which is now going on still very, very much within the Islamic world, and is sweeping over the Islamic world with different kinds of expressions, some extreme, some very intellectual, some in between. We're in the middle of a process which is not by any means homogeneous, but which is different in different Islamic countries, but nevertheless is going on everywhere, from Indonesia to Morocco and every land in between. Now let me turn to modernism itself. I believe that in a deeper sense, the age of modernism is over. I've written so much about this. Many of my Turkish friends who are here have read my books, which have been translated into Turkish. You know that people like me do not talk about modernism in a vague sense as anything that happens to be around that is not, that's today's, that is contemporary. First of all, we prefer to use the term modernism than modernity. I know that there are theoretical philosophers of modernity, like Habermas, who prefer the use of the term modernity. But for me, what does modernity mean philosophically? If it's not a system of thinking, I'm looking at the world. Now, once you have a system, the ism goes much better with it. So you have modernism as a philosophy about the nature of things, nature of the world, the nature of human beings, the meaning of life, science, philosophy, everything. Modernism claims to be a total way of looking at the nature of reality. And it grew in Europe at the end of the Middle Ages, in the Renaissance, and especially with the coming of the scientific revolution in the 17th century, and later on the rise of modern philosophy, or about the same time with Descartes, we have modernism. I believe that this paradigm of modernism, which dominated over the West for the last 400 years, is finished. It's dying. And the rise of postmodernism from within the belly of modernism. Postmodernism did not begin in Cairo. It began in Paris. It began from within the very heart of the modernist enterprise. That's a sign of it. And the fact that the criticism of modernism began not from those who were being colonized by modernism, whether they were Chinese or Arabs or Turks or Indonesians, but from within the West itself at first. The writings and the remarkable writings of René Guénon, which appeared in the 1920s, and it was The Christ of the Modern World, is like a prophetic book, which still sells a lot more books than that of any French philosopher who happens to be living in Paris right now, even now, after 75, 80 years, whatever it is. This criticism that began to come out showed that, as I said jokingly once, not all is well in the kingdom of Denmark, as Shakespeare said, as there was something seriously wrong. And I believe that cosmetics and trying to patch up the cracks in the wall of modernism are not going to work. The most blatant result of modernism, of course, is the environmental crisis. Because people can be indifferent to a spiritual illness. It's very difficult to be indifferent when our physical world is crashing down upon us. When the god of science and technology, as one of the big gods of modernism, predicts that there's no danger in drilling oil offshore, and one mistake, one lie, changes the ecological system of one of the most important and delicate ecosystems of the world, the Gulf of Mexico. And God knows what consequences that we're going to have to face for years. We don't even know about it. We live in such times. And therefore, I believe, especially for Muslims, the time of simply copying modernism in the West as if a machine is producing pages one after another is finished. And the sooner we wake up, the better it is. Otherwise, we'll simply be repeating mistakes. And now the globe can't support it anymore. There was a time when the world was big enough and we could support mistakes. Now it's we have so little space left, so little time left, so few possibilities left. And the rest of the world cannot make the mistakes that the West made to get to this point. You cannot pollute all the rivers of the world like the British polluted the Thames River in the 19th century. The reason they did that was because the other rivers of the world were not polluted. As I said the other day, if the Nile and the Yangtze and Ganges River had been polluted in the 19th century, the way the Thames River would not be around anymore, as the earth would not be able to support the biosystem which allows us to live as human beings on the earth. So I think that modernism is a very, very deep crisis, and it's about time that we pay attention to where we are in this moment of history, and as Muslims try to forge a meaningful future, as many thinkers in the West are trying to do for the West itself. But the West cannot think for us. It cannot decide for us, no more than we can decide for the West. Each civilization must have its own independence to forge its own future. And this brings me to the last point, the future. As you know, I'm sure Professor Cox knows, one of the most often heard sentences in every Islamic country is, inshallah, if God wills, which comes from Arabic, and we have it in Turkish and Persian and Urdu and every Islamic language. Inshallah, if God wills. A Muslim never thinks of anything about the future without saying, inshallah. Here I say, I'll see you tomorrow. We say, inshallah. I, as a humble, not even Muslim thinker, Muslim, who tries to be a person of faith, do not put any faith in futurologies. If you read these scenarios of 50 years ago for the future, they sound so funny now. None of them came true. Some little things here and there, yes. Toffler's Future Shock. Go and read it now. Get it out of the library. The bestseller. 40 years ago. That's not what has happened. There are too many imponderables, too many question marks to be able to predict the future. Nevertheless, even from the Islamic religious point of view, God wants us to plan for the future. Imam Ali said, live as if you were going to die tomorrow and live as if you were going to live 1,000 years. It's our duty to plan for the future, but we don't know what the future is. It's in God's hands. If you ask me as a humble observer of the human condition, as a person who's had a little experience in both the Islamic world and the West and a little bit elsewhere in the world, I would say that, first of all, we live in a period of great uncertainty. The hubris of the human species has to come to an end. The hubris of the human species has to come to an end. Otherwise, we're going to be slapped by nature in a way that we don't know whether we're coming or going. I believe, putting everything else aside, the spiritual questions aside, I believe that nature will have the last word when it comes to the environmental crisis, which is the cardinal, central problem for the future for all of humanity today. But not as important as the spiritual reason, which will cause the environmental crisis. Alas, I do not have time to get into that. I also believe that for the future, religion is not going to die. All of the fandango technologies that they're making, all of the attacks by the biologists and so forth and so on, are not going to affect the deep need of the human being for the spirit, for the spiritual world. That's as deep as the air that we breathe, the need for it. And the same way that if there's going to be a human future, there's going to have to be air for us to breathe. It's as real and fundamental as that. There will be the need for religion, and there will be religion. In fact, I think religions will go from strength to strength, while on the social level there'll be a lot of contention. Spiritually, there'll be deeper and deeper need for religion, and the spiritual element of religion in every religion are going to attract more and more people. This is my belief. Right now in the Islamic world, this is not the case. Both Islamic modernists and fundamentalists have pitted themselves against the more spiritual inner dimensions of the Islamic tradition, including tasawwuf, Sufism. But that, I don't think, is a long-term solution. I think everyone realizes that the most profound intellectual response that the Islamic world gives to the challenge of the West comes from the inner dimension of Islam. Not from fiqh, that's very important on its own level, that is Islamic law and jurisprudence, but the intellectual question, intellectual problems that we are facing and we will face more and more in the future will have to come from the great tradition of Islamic thought, of falsafa, of irfan, of kalam, and all the other traditions, intellectual traditions, which in fact are castigated by the Salafis on the one hand and the modernists on the other. They're pushed aside. But those, I believe, are going to make a very major comeback. They're already doing so. The resuscitation of the whole intellectual tradition of Islam, which began several decades ago, and we have several very prominent Turkish scholars. I'm in this room, my friend Dr. Kilic, Ibrahim, who's been studying me for many years, and many, many others who are now, even in Turkey, which was the vanguard of modernism in the 19th and early 20th century, this idea of the revival of the Islamic intellectual tradition is going on, and I think the future will be observing that. Finally, one last point. I believe that there is no future unless we're able to live together. And living together, meaning accepting the other with some respect. I don't mean to accept everything the other says, but accept the other as also being worthy of living and being respected and given the space, the living space, to function. And I believe that the meeting between religions, accord between religions, what in Arabic is called wifaq, a kind of harmony between religions, is not only a reality now, but it will be even more a reality of the future, because it's one of the greatest necessities of human life. One of the phenomena in the future is that religion will oftentimes, for most people, will be combined with the experience that religions There have been people of different faith living in different places, and this separation, which made the homogeneous religious atmosphere of different civilizations possible, is going to change to some extent. I know that Professor Cox has spoken about this in several of his articles. I haven't read his new book that he just gave to me. I congratulate him and give him the floor.
First of all, I want to express my deep gratitude to the municipality of Istanbul for making this meeting possible and for making possible my very first visit to this beautiful and historic city that I have read about throughout my whole life, and now at long last I'm here to see it and to enjoy it. I want to thank Professor Kalin for this particular event. And especially, I'm grateful for seeing once again and conversing with my old friend, Dr. Nasser. I want to thank him for those eloquent and thoughtful remarks with which he started our conversation. I'm searching for something to disagree with. And there are a few things, but not many. I think we find ourselves very much on the same page. I had to ask myself when I started writing this book called The Future of Religion, and I thought back to all of those confident predictions that were made in the late 19th and indeed in the early 20th century, even when I was starting my work as a student in the field of religion, those confident predictions about the disappearance, the marginalization of religion, that religion would no longer have any role in shaping the public discourse or in shaping cultures. It wasn't very long ago that those predictions were still being made. Now here you'll have to say that these are perhaps the most mistaken, the most dramatically and visibly mistaken of any of the predictions made. That simply did not happen. But then I had to take another step. Ask myself, why were those predictions so wrong? Why did thoughtful and well-informed people make those kinds of forecasts, which turned out not to be the case? And I think there are a couple reasons which lead us into the discussion scheduled for today. One was that modernity and religion were projected as absolutely contradictory phenomena. If we were going to have modernity, religion would disappear. If you're going to have religion, modernity would not have a chance. Now, this turned out to be not at all the case. The fact is that in some countries which would have to be considered modern, my own country is an example, religion has in fact continued to flourish, much to the surprise of many Europeans who come to America and find, in fact, a rather religious country, especially in contrast to Western Europe at the time. But it's true of some other countries as well. And I think perhaps one of the reasons for this was that modernity itself was made entirely too monolithic, was thought of as too monolithic. In fact, what was happening around the world were what we would now have to call multiple modernities. Multiple modernities. They're not all the same. There are differences depending on whether it's happening in Japan, or South America, or the Middle East, or Turkey, or the United States, or Europe. They took on different shapes, and some of those shapes were indeed anti-religious. In some, there was an interesting compromise, sometimes a very creative compromise, between religion and modernity. In other places, other things happened. So one of the points I'd like to add to our discussion today, Dr. Nasser, is have we, to some extent, oversimplified our analysis of something called modernity? is it a much more complex phenomenon than we had once believed. Now, if you begin to take apart this concept, modernity, what do you find? And this is another reason why I think those forecasts were so wrong. Modernity, at least in the West, especially in Europe, emerged as a vision of the Enlightenment and the post-Enlightenment era, in which there was a mixture of observation, philosophy, and frankly, ideology. The idea of modernity was in some place in large measure an anti-religious ideology mixed in with some other kinds of empirical and historical observations. Now, in the United States, the version of the Enlightenment which came to the United States was not particularly anti-religious. The Constitution of the United States and some of our history indicates that religion influenced the formation of our founding documents. It has influenced our history ever since. Some of the most important movements in American history, most recently, the Civil Rights Movement, which transformed the racial composition of America, which really took a long step beyond racial discrimination, was led by and inspired by religious figures, Martin Luther King being only one of the exemplars. And Martin Luther King, who throughout his life identified himself and his cause, which was really the cause of all of us, identified with Moses, the prophet Moses, leading people out of oppression and captivity into a new horizon of freedom. I was active myself in that civil rights movement. I had the honor of knowing and working with Dr. King, one of the great human beings I have ever met, a man of enormous courage and a very, very deep religious conviction. The struggle against the American war in Vietnam was led in large measure by religious figures. So religion was not marginated and not abolished in the American experience. Rather, it became very differentiated. It often puzzles visitors to America to see all the different expressions of religion that we have. All the different denominations and churches that dot our land, and to notice how many people are still attending and participating in those churches. And now, to those churches, one has to add mosques all over the country, Buddhist pagodas, and other houses of worship, because the diversity of the American religious scene is increasing and not decreasing. So that in America today, one has to know about and relate to other religious traditions simply to live in any of our cities or in most of the sections of our country. Illustrate this, a few years ago, a young man who was a senior about to graduate from Harvard College came in to see me. He was a chemistry major. He was preparing to be a physician, go to medical school. And he said to me, "Could you recommend a course in religion that I could take here before I graduate?" I said, "Well, why at this last minute are you interested in taking a course in religion?" He said, "Well, here's why. My laboratory partner in chemistry is a Muslim. My girlfriend is a Buddhist. My roommate is Jewish." He said, "Now, I think I better learn something about some of these religions just in order to get along well with my friends." Now, to me, that is a very, very telling anecdote. It means that the interreligious dialogue that we are advocating and, in fact, participating in today is not something simply carried on by philosophers and theologians and scholars. It's going on in many places, in snack bars, in college dormitories, in laboratories, in people who meet each other all around the world, and not just in the United States, although I happen to believe that we have a wonderful opportunity in America with as many different religious expressions as we have there. I'm thankful for those. I'm thankful that we have all of this as a challenge to whether we can, in fact, be a country in which these different traditions can thrive, these different religious traditions can thrive and flourish, learn from each other, live with each other, and become even stronger because of their interaction. I hope so. So we have multiple modernities, but further, here I would underline a point that Dr. Nasser has made. We are living, I think, at the moment of the great train wreck of most of the ideas of modernity. It's a train wreck. And it's a good time to get off the train before the wreck finally occurs. What did modernity mean? It meant the organization of the world in national states. This is an idea whose time is over. Believe me, those people who live on the shore of the Gulf of Mexico, whether it's in Central America or wherever, won't be helped by the fact that they live in separate national states when the oil begins to encroach on their shorelines and kill all of their animals and birds and poison the water, perhaps for generations to come. Nationalism will not help. And in the last part of the 20th century, early 20th century, we saw the catastrophe of nationalism played out in a tragic and way throughout most of Europe. That's over. It was the era in which some people told us that science and technology would have the answer to all of our human questions. However, it turns out that although science and technology are enormously useful, helpful, they are tools. And the decision of how a tool is to be used is not itself a scientific question. It's not a scientific question. Science itself has no resources to answer. For example, we know how to make nuclear weapons. Of course. Should we make nuclear weapons? It's not a scientific question. It's a spiritual, it's a religious, it's an ethical question. For which science has no answer. Should we proceed with the cloning of new human beings? That can be done. Should we do it? That's not a scientific question. That's a question of ethics, of religion, maybe even of theology. So we have come to the point at which at least the limitations of the scientific method have now become very, very evident. And I think this catastrophic oil spill is a particularly vivid illustration of this problem. You see, I think, in a way, Dr. Nasser, that the ecological crisis is, in fact, a spiritual crisis. It is a spiritual crisis. It has to do with human beings misusing and distorting God's creation, a gift to us, created not by us, created by God, for which we are the caretakers, and we have violated that responsibility in a fantastic way. So it is a spiritual question. And I agree with you so much. We will not have the last word. Nature will have the last word here. And we are all challenged, whatever religion or culture we belong to work together to prevent this ultimate catastrophe, which is simply on the horizon now and moving toward us. Now, as far as the future of religion, and I want to use the word in the plural, religions. We live in a world of religions. I firmly believe that as long as human beings need to find a meaning in life, need to find values they can live by and trust, need to find a community of those who support and help them along life's way, need to have a sense of dignity, that a human being is important and not just some kind of result of natural process, has a specific spiritual importance. And as long as human beings need a hope for a future of peace, shalom, interaction, peaceful interaction, as long as that exists within human beings, there will be religions. Religions have historically addressed themselves to these fundamental, unchanging, and persistent human questions, and they will continue to do so. Now, they respond in somewhat different ways, but I think the contradictions between and among religions has often been overemphasized, and I'm very grateful that we are now standing on the threshold of a very new era in which we are searching patiently and carefully for what it is we have in common. And there are more and more things we discover that Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Christians have in common, and we'll be exploring and deepening, in my view, the things that we have in common. I want to say a word or two about Christianity in particular. It's my own faith, and the one that I have worked mainly to try to understand. I'm just beginning to understand it after nearly 50 years of work in this field. Say something about the future of Christianity. The first and most important thing to say about Christianity, I hope everyone here remembers it, is as of 1975, more or less, Christianity was no longer a Western religion. No longer a Western religion. And should be, therefore, all the textbooks about Western religions and Eastern religions are now obsolete. The majority of Christians now live outside of the old Christendom era, of area, of Europe and North America. Africa, Asia, the Asian Rim, South America, China especially, where one of the fastest growing areas for Christianity. So we now have, by a rough count in the world, about 2 billion Christians, it is said, a little bit more perhaps, about 1 billion or a little bit more Muslims. The two largest religious movements in the whole world. Think what could happen. Think what could happen in the interests of world peace, of ecological sanity, of justice for the poor and the hungry. What could happen if we, 3.5 billion, could somehow agree that these issues are spiritual issues that should drive us to cooperation in the future? It's a wonderful vision, and I think it's, in fact, beginning to happen. And one of the most important features of what I call the de-Westernization of Christianity, is that the areas where Christianity is growing tend to be the areas in which there is more interaction and interchange with other religions. Islam in Africa, for example, Buddhism in Asia, Hinduism in South Asia, and Christians there are beginning to ask new kinds of theological questions which had never arisen in the in Western Christianity, simply because those other ways of thinking, of other ways of praying, other ways of being religious, were not present as real challenges. Now they are. And I look forward to that. I think it'll be a real liberation. The other thing that means has to do with the founder of this city, namely the Emperor Constantine. Constantine did one very good thing. I think he did one very bad thing. The good thing he did was to found this city. He called it Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul. Nevertheless, I am grateful that there is such a city. The other thing he did that I think was, however, destructive, was that in the early 4th century of the Common Era, around 330 of the Common Era, he insisted that all Christians should subscribe to a single religious creed, to obey a single hierarchy, and this creed and this hierarchy would be enforced by the Roman Empire. So he called together the Christian leaders, as you know, in Nicaea, and really inflicted on them one particular creed. Up until then, for three centuries, Christianity was flourishing around the Mediterranean world. It was flourishing without a central hierarchy, without a single creed, and certainly without imperial oversight. But what we saw was, the imperialization of Christianity, and I think we have been reaping the disaster which that caused ever since. Identifying Christianity with the empire contributed to the Crusades, contributed to many destructive and bad things. But I think the fact that now Christianity is growing outside of that old realm is the most profound change in centuries. Perhaps even more important than the changes that took place at the time of the Protestant Reformation. Now let me say just a word or two about the relationship of Christianity to Islam, which is part of our conversation today. Do I have another minute or two? Thank you. I regret to say that one of my colleagues at Harvard University, named Professor Huntington, circulated an idea some years ago, not only that civilizations have at their cores a religious tradition, but that these civilizations were fated to be in a kind of conflict, the clash of civilizations. Now, many of us disagreed with him at the time. He died a few years ago. May he rest in peace. But one of the great ironies for me, professionally and intellectually, is when he retired, his secretary became my secretary. A secretary serving two extremely different worldviews, I would say. I not only do not believe that we are fated for a clash of civilization, I think that whole idea is a destructive prophesying one, self-fulfilling prophecy, but I think we're on the threshold of the kind of conversation, convivencia, that we have never had before. We've never had it before. And I hope and I pray, inshallah, that we do not lose and spoil this opportunity. Maybe it will only be given to us once in human history. But here we are. We're on the threshold of this great conversation, learning from each other, appreciating each other, not just tolerating each other, which is very minimal, but learning from each other. This is my hope for the future of Islam and Christianity, and I think there's all kinds of evidence that it's beginning to happen. I cite here only one, which is the exciting Common Word program, which was initiated by a group of Muslim scholars, including Dr. Nasser, and responded to by a group of Christian theologians and scholars, including myself, and we've already had a number of very fruitful conversations. They are not the only conversations. Conversations are going on at other levels as well, including, as I said, at the breakfast table, in the dormitories, in the laboratories, as people of different religions, especially younger people, get to know each other, talk with each other. Now, so I think that Dr. Huntington was right in part. I think civilizations do have a kind of a core of a religious tradition. However, I do not think, and there's no evidence, that they are essentially inimical to each other. I think not. One of the difficulties, in fact, of the Christian-Muslim dialogue is precisely and ironically that we are so close. We are so close. We share many of the prophets. We share a belief in one God. There are many things that we share together. we are all children of Abraham. But the psychologists tell us that some of the most difficult rivalries are sibling rivalries. I can testify to that, having had four children. Sibling rivalries can be very, very noisy. Nonetheless, it creates both an opportunity and a challenge. Christians don't quite have that issue with Buddhists, but with Muslims we do. So it will require considerable more patience, I think, on our part. But I, for one, am grateful for the astonishing kind and welcome kind of openness that Muslim scholars, both in the Islamic world itself and in the West, have demonstrated as we begin to take this step toward this conversation. I'll close with this observation. Perhaps this is a kind of a challenge to all of you who are here. We have now at my university, and at many other universities in America, dozens, perhaps hundreds, maybe even thousands, of students, who Christian students and Jewish students, who are studying Islam, who are learning Arabic, who are reading the Quran and studying it, who are talking about Islamic philosophy, who are reading the books of Professor Nasser. There are increasing numbers of these people preparing themselves, not just for a conversation, but for a conversation in which they are well informed about the other party in the conversation. Unfortunately, I do not think there is a comparable number of young Muslims in Muslim countries or in other places who are studying the history of Christianity, the Bible, the theology of the various branches of Christianity. So I wish there were. And I'm challenging those of you who are now planning your university careers or your professional intellectual vocations for the future. We need a well-informed conversation, not a conversation out of ignorance. Final word. And that is the role of Rumi. The role of Rumi, the great Persian poet. Most of you probably don't know that the best-selling poet among students across America, according to Booksellers magazine, is Rumi. Rumi is becoming a kind of a spiritual source for thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of young people who find in him a spiritual depth that they can relate to and resonate to. And it leads me to suggest, in closing, that in addition to the political and cultural, theological, philosophical conversation, this sharing of our traditions at this deep spiritual level is probably what is finally most essential. Thank you.
As Dr. Cox said, reciprocally, most of what he said I agree with, and there are very few points on which we disagree, but I just wanted to elucidate in just 10 minutes, very, very quickly, some of the points which I feel need a bit of more, greater clarification. First of all, the diversity and complexity of modernities. I would be the last person to doubt that, and that's why I use the term modernism as a philosophy. The humanism, rationalism, homocentric nature, and so forth, of the philosophy of modernism, in fact, is more or less coherent wherever it went, except it never succeeded fully anywhere in any society to become the only force, the only dominant force. And that is why modernity in America was so different from continental Europe. It came from England, and the Age of Enlightenment in England did not have the same virulent anti-religious color to it as the Âge de Lumière, the Age of Enlightenment, had in France. And that's the reason why at the beginning of the American Revolution, people like Benjamin Franklin and Jefferson, who were deists, who had been influenced, in fact, by French philosophy, were nevertheless deists who believed in God, and were more like English figures of the Age of Enlightenment than those who completely denied the divinity in the French Enlightenment. And that helped the preservation of religion to a large extent, and I would certainly be the last person to deny that. He speaks very correctly about how religious dialogue is sort of ubiquitous in the United States, and it's not only among the scholars. I want to make this comment that religious dialogue become necessitated in relation to the breakdown of a particular religious universe. That is, to the extent that modernism destroys the homogeneity of a particular religious universe, interest in other religions increases. It is not accidental that the students of divinity at Harvard are more interested in Islamic studies than the students of Islam and Al-Azhar University are interested in Christian studies. To the extent that Egypt becomes as secularized as Cambridge, Massachusetts, that's going to happen. And it's not unique to Islam. Hindu students in Benares are less interested in studying Christianity than Harvard students are studying with Diana Eck about Hinduism. This is a very important phenomenon that occurs with the spread of modernism. I myself have always tried to encourage Muslim students to study more other religions, including Christianity. When I was dean of the faculty at Lajjar Tehran University, I immediately instituted a chair of Sanskrit. So I would not think there are only we and the West, there are other civilizations in the world. And we began to teach Hinduism, Buddhism, in addition to Christianity. And today in Qom, in the city of Qom, perhaps more than in any other Islamic religious city, there are texts of Christianity being studied, including his own books. Harvey Cox's books exist in Persian, and they're being studied by mullahs who have a turban on their head and are going to become the future clerics. So this movement is going on within the Islamic world to the extent that its need is felt. The fact that it was not done before was that the need was not felt. In the same way that at the Divinity School of Harvard, when William James was teaching, the need to know Islam was not felt, so there was no Islamic thought. So this is not a question of one nation or one culture or the other. It's a question of internal dynamics, which I think is shared by all religions. I could not agree more with him about the question of certain things being dépassé, including the nation-state, nationalism, which grew out of the French Revolution. But let's look at the real political situation. The very part of the world which invented modern nationalism, that is the West, now realizes how useless this concept is. But the Islamic world, most of which is still politically dominated by the West, doesn't dare put aside the nations created by Western colonialists. The best example, of course, is the First Iraqi War. When Iraq took over one of the former provinces of the province of Iraq under the Ottoman period, there was no country of Kuwait. There was one province called Iraq during the Ottoman period, which had different parts, including Kuwait. As soon as Iraq decided to take over Kuwait, the hell broke loose and a war was declared, and you know what happened. And even the little states created by the British in the Persian Gulf, if any of them would decide to unite, the greatest pressure would be put on them by the West not to do so. It is the preservation of the lines of nation-state created by Western colonial powers is being kept with all the might that the West has, which is quite interesting. While in the West itself, these lines are becoming more and more diluted. I could not agree more with Professor Cox that this is now a time to put aside this kind of way of thinking even. The problems that we face are global. The fish that are going to die in Mexico, although they don't have American citizenship, will die from the oil that was off the coastline of Louisiana, and they have no choice. And almost every problem, I was saying yesterday, the thinning of the zone of ion in the sky, which affects the gamma rays that reach our eyes and hurt our eyes, although it wasn't done by people in Turkey, will affect their eyes if they're walking in Edirne. This interconnection makes it necessary for us to go beyond that kind of nationalism, but the West is against it, very much against it. And the Islamic world is not powerful enough politically to overcome that opposition, and it's important to mention that. Dr. Cox mentions that we are at the threshold of a new age. I agree, but what kind of new age? Is it the age of the Antichrist, or is it the age of the Mahdi? We are living in apocalyptic times in many ways. People in all religions, not only Abrahamic religions, Hindus, Buddhists expect the coming of the Kali Avatar, and according to their own religion, a kind of major spiritual transformation taking place in the world. And Muslims expect the coming of the Mahdi, the Christians expect the coming of Christ. There are even Christian sects created among Protestants based solely on this idea a few decades ago, which is now becoming more organized. But at first was just a kind of apocalyptic interpretation of Christianity. What I would like to speak against very, very strongly is not to do the work of the Mahdi for him. That is, I'm against one single world religion. I think if one single world religion created by us human beings could only be a demonic creation. It would really be the rule of the Antichrist. But the religions of the world were given by God. They were not invented by us. And all people in the world, sometimes with good intention, who make a mistake between friendship between religions and creating one world religion, have really to be warned how dangerous this idea is. I, for one, I think almost all Muslims stand against this. Christianity would believe with the coming of Christ, everyone would become Christian. Muslims believe with the coming of the Mahdi, everyone would become Muslim. And these are eschatological events. Let's not force the hand of God. Let me just put it mildly. The important thing is to respect other religions while guarding our own. A word about Christianity as a non-Western religion. Of course, Christianity is a non-Western religion. Palestine is not in the West. And there have been Oriental Christians for centuries. Even in India, there's a very old Christian community going back to the first century, to the Apostle Thomas. In my own country, Iran. In Turkey, there have been the oldest Christian communities. And, of course, Syria and some of the oldest churches in the world are around here. But that's not quite the same thing as what is happening today. It's interesting in Lebanon, the Maronite Church sided with the Vatican. And from the time of the colonization of Lebanon by the French after 1866, the Maronite Church acted as the right hand for French colonization. Whereas the Orthodox Church, which had not sided with the Vatican, remained independent of Western influences. Today, much of the Western, non-Western spread of Christianity, although geographically non-Western, is dominated completely by Western interests and the Western, modern Western way of thinking. In Korea, to become modernized and become Christian is the same word. And consumerism, which is one of, I think, great illnesses that were created in the West, which is destroying the environment, is much, much higher among Korean Christians and Korean Buddhists. So there's a nexus, and what would have to happen is the development of a non-Western Christianity, which is not only geographically non-Western, but it's also theologically and culturally non-Western. Like, as I say, the Orthodox Church of Syria, the Syrian Orthodox Church. Its political stance, its cultural stance, its linguistic stance, in the way of looking at things, is Syrian. It is not based on Western missionary activity, and it unfortunately tries to introduce people to Christianity not because of the love of Christ, but because of vaccines for cows and more wealth and rice and so forth and so on, with all the great tragedies that we also see in South America, and you all know about it. And finally, let me conclude by saying that the duty of Muslims, here I'm speaking in an Islamic country, it's not only to learn about these problems that was a cause and I'm discussing with you, but also to really take a serious step to produce Muslim thinkers who understand Christian theology, Christian thought, and ultimately other religions. I've said for 50 years that we need Muslim Occidentalists. There are plenty of Orientalists who have studied the East. And we even have Muslim Orientalists who copy the West way of studying themselves. We've been doing that for decades and centuries. Time has come to have Western Occidentalists, and the heart of that is to have West Muslims who understand the Christian tradition, who know Latin and Greek, who can read St. Thomas Aquinas, who can read St. Bonaventure, who know the Christian tradition in depth, not only the last 100 years, but going back to its foundation. And I think that's something which is among the most important responsibilities of Muslims today, and I'm very glad to say that of all the Islamic countries, the country which has taken at least one little step in this direction is Turkey. I know almost all the students, Muslim students, studying this subject in the Vatican, Gregorian University, and other places. The number of Turks is the largest, that is, there are few people. But the Islamic world is a big place. We need more than a dozen people like that. And I'm very glad Professor Cox brought this point up, and I hope this will be one of the results of our discussion today, to turn more attention at people to become Muslim Christian theologians, not dissolve in Christianity that they were no longer Islamic thinkers. When John Hick, let's say, writes about Islam, he doesn't cease to be a Protestant theologian from the United Kingdom, or other people, many Catholics who write about it. To produce people in reverse, people who are deeply rooted in the Islamic intellectual tradition, but who are able to study the Western religious tradition seriously. And also Judaism, not only Christianity, but also Judaism. But Christianity being such a large religion, of course, is our most important duty.